قلبي.
And yes, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org. Click on the big red oval. Since we are still without a radio transmitter, a physical old-fashioned transmitter, which is to say we actually have one, which is in perfect working order, but we do not have a place to put it up as yet. That would mean that listening to me live now, you would only be listening online. So be sure to tell all your friends to click on that big red oval, which is atop the picture of the old-fashioned transmitter. This is the Mideast Madness Show for Saturday, November 2nd, 2013. It is 11:03 a.m. And if that matches with your personal time-space continuum, then you know the show is live. 11:03 a.m., November 2nd. Hence, you may call in at any time, and I will pick up the phone, and we shall talk, or burp at each other, maybe even yell, but I will not yell. I will endeavor not to yell at you. The phone number here, live to the studio, area code 831-427-3772. That's 831-427-3772. And don't forget, at any time, you may dish out a one-way comm to me, to this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. Again, G as in gregarious, M as in maligned, X as in xenophobic, .com, MideastMadness@gmx.com. Enjoy the music here. Just checking my messages. Okay. Mideast Madness comes to you twice a week, every Saturday, 11 a.m., running up until 1 in the afternoon. I like to call it the weekend edition so I can pretend that I'm a big wig national public radio commentator. Hence, Mideast Madness Weekend Edition, Saturdays at 11 a.m., and the much longer standing program every Monday at 3 p.m., 3 until almost 5 in the afternoon, every Monday. So, what's on the agenda today? From this Palestinian American who doesn't mind admitting that his motivations for doing the program are obviously marked by my sentiment toward the Palestinian cause, never forgetting that the overall target of this program is to help establish peace, justice, and ultimately reconciliation amongst the parties involved in the Israeli-Arab conflict. Mazin Kumsiye is editor-in-chief of his human rights newsletter. I see that he has a YouTube video. Let's see what that's about, shall we?
Welcome back to The X Factor. As the holding room starts to thin, many are leaving with their dreams in tatters. But for our next contestant, the opportunity to chase that dream is all he ever wanted.
What's your name?
Emmanuel. I'm Emmanuel. I'm 17 years of age and I live in Australia, originally from Iraq. I'm auditioning for X Factor because the dream is to become a professional singer, and I definitely want to be the best. At boarding school, I sing every day, every night. My mates say, you know, what are you singing, mate? Just shush, we're trying to concentrate here, so, yeah. If I went X Factor, oh, my God. Words can't even describe it. Wow. How you doing?
What's your name?
Emmanuel.
Emmanuel. So who's here with you today?
My mum, my cousin, my auntie, and my brother.
How old are you?
Well, actually, I'm not exactly sure. When I was originally found in Iraq in an orphanage, my mum found me. I was born with no birth certificate. No passport, nothing.
My story is that I was born in the middle of a war zone. My brother and I, we were found by the nuns in a box in a park, in a shoebox. They brought me to the orphanage. We'd hear shots, noises that we didn't understand. It was like looking at an angel when Mum Moira Kelly walked through the orphanage door. She brought us both to Australia for surgery originally.
Both of these young individuals are without hands or forearms, and Emmanuel walks with a decided, with an obvious limp. It appears as though at least one of his legs has been shortened.
And then, sort of, Mum fell in love with both of us. My hero would have to be my mother. She worked very, very hard, extremely hard, to change my life hugely. You know, some people say I was a man without an identity, but with my mother and with my brother, I believe that I can do this, you know.
Wow, good on you, man.
Thank you.
Good on you, man.
Emmanuel is standing at a microphone at a set, TV studio set, which is modeled after the American Idol set, where you have four judges, in this case, sitting in front of him. And it appears as though Emmanuel has some talent he wants to share with them.
So what are you going to sing?
I'm going to sing Imagine by John Lennon.
Beautiful. Oh. Good luck, mate.
Thank you.
Imagine there's no heaven.
This is Emmanuel Kelly singing a student.
If you try.
17-year-old student with no hands.
No hell below us. was only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Yahoo! Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to live or die for, and no religion to. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one.
Whoa, man.
I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one.
The judges are clearly overwhelmed. One of the women is in tears. Smiles on everyone else's face. Very happy mother hugging her son.
I don't think I've ever been moved as much as I was by that performance. That was magnificent. Your courage, your bravery is unbelievable.
Thank you.
Emmanuel, you kind of won us over from the minute you stepped onto this stage. You just had this cheeky grin and this confidence. Everything about you, I just love.
Emmanuel, you're a great singer. And I'm not saying that because you've had a hard life, because it's the thing to say. You, compared to the other people here, regardless of your story, you've got a beautiful gift, and you moved everyone in this room.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, I want to commend you on your courage and your bravery. It's really moving and really touching. And above all, you thoroughly entertained everyone. Everybody here was smiling.
Yes, guys.
And for that, I thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Emmanuel, we have to vote. I would definitely like to see more of you in this competition. It's a yes from me, man.
It's a yes from me.
I can't wait to hear what you're going to sing next. It's a yes from me.
It's a yes from me.
Well done, man.
Makes everything that you worry about just so pathetic.
Oh God, man.
We need some tissues.
Well done, everybody.
We're done.
So to go and hug the world. Go and hug the world. I'll see you soon, man. See you, buddy. See you soon. I'll see you there.
No, he was. That was incredible, and that was the most moving performance I think I've ever seen, like ever. Yeah.
Alexander Kelly his brother were found barely alive in a shoebox, as he related the story to the judges, prefacing his performance of John Lennon's Imagine. A 17-year-old student, Alexander Kelly, adopted by an Australian family. Apparently, both boys grew up in Australia. Ethnic Iraqis, amid the turmoil, devastation of the violence in Iraq, and I do not know, you know, if he's 17 now and he was found as an infant or a newborn, perhaps, along with his brother, would have meant there was still pre-war violence going on in Iraq. Now, I'm pretty sure he did say Iraq, that that's where they found him. Both boys without hands, little more than stubs for arms, and a massive limp that allows Alexander to carry himself. Well, I was certainly moved by that. Maybe it's only this idol, American Idol atmosphere that does it to me, but everyone was just so happy and so emotional. Now, I admit, when I saw this video, I thought it might have had to do with Arab Idol, because a few months ago, a Palestinian national, and I say national in every sincere every sincere sense of the word. I can't remember that dude's name, but a Palestinian did win the Pan-Arabic, which is to say popularly broadcast across most of the Arab world. The Pan-National Arab Idol Contest was won by a Palestinian, and I thought that was what we were going to see, but I'm perfectly happy with what I saw and heard and with what you heard. I hope my attempts to clarify some things went over well. Again, this is actually from Mazin Kumsiyes, Human Rights e-newsletter. And that certainly was nothing but positive start to his new newsletter. And now, Mazin goes on expressly to say, from now on, our posts will have more positive than negative links and stories. And no better way to emphasize that. But alas, he goes on immediately to say, but first, an unclassified note, time will tell the impact. And this is dated today, November 2nd, 2:09 a.m. He goes on to say, Israeli warplanes attacked Syria. The Palestinian negotiating team submitted its resignation following Israel's announcement of building thousands of new Jewish colonial settler homes on Palestinian lands, and its announcement of thousands of home demolitions for native Jerusalemites, that is to say, non-Jewish Arab native Jerusalemites. The significance is unknown, since it seems these same guys keep going back to, quote, negotiations, and have convinced themselves that they have no options to maintain their salaries, in other words. The definition of madness is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. I guess Mazin had to get that out of the way. subheading, being positive. Switching gears here. Today, Saturday, November 5, he says November 5, but obviously he means November 2. Today, Saturday, November the 2nd, we meet in Ramallah for a study day to work and organize for a positive future. One democratic secular state in historic Palestine. Ramallah, of course, is a large city in the West Bank, within the state of Palestine, as civilized people refer to it. Ramallah is the current de facto capital of the state of Palestine. I'll continue. Actually, Mazin has a number of links. 29 photos that put all of our struggles in perspective. Mazin Kumsier is spelled, first name, M-A-Z-I-N. Kumsier, Q-U-M-S-I-Y-E-H. You may do a search for Mazin Kumsier. And to enjoy and appreciate the power of his news links and for the 29 photos that put all of our struggles in perspective. Oh, this man really is putting in a variety of topics under the general title of positive. Birth in Nature, Amazing Gift of Life. Another link goes to Forget Survival of the Fittest. It is kindness that counts. A psychologist probes how altruism, Darwinism, and neurobiology mean that we can succeed by not being cutthroat. Wow. You see, Mr. Kumsier, obviously being editor of this human rights newsletter, effectively is blogging through this venue. This is very different. He is taking a turn. Hopefully this will work out for him. A photographer documents as his wife fades away with breast cancer. A few more tears. Now, this next link catches my eye. Great new book, Max Blumenthal's Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, from therealnews.com. Now, if you've been listening to my recent shows, you've heard me speak quite a bit about Max Blumenthal, mentioning his book. Looks like we have something of a video. From therealnews.com.
Welcome to The Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay, and welcome to Reality Asserts Itself. When I was a teenager in the late 1960s, I visited a relative in Israel. She'd gone to live on a kibbutz. If at that time a political leader of Israel had talked in overt racist language, had talked about cleansing Israel of its Arab population, I think the people my relative knew would have been appalled. Most Israelis I ran into, and I think it would be true to say most Israelis in general, would not accept that they belonged to a state that was essentially racist, and certainly would not accept their political leaders talking that way. Well, these days, there are political leaders in Israel that talk exactly like that, and one of the faces of that is Avigdor Lieberman, who was Israel's foreign minister. In a new book by Max Blumenthal titled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, Max looks at this growing racism or growing overt racism in Israel. And early in the book, he looks at the life and personality and role of Mr. Lieberman.
Let me do some identification here. This, again, is the website for therealnews.com. The show is hosted by Mr. Paul Jay. He's going to talk about Blumenthal's book, This is part one of a series of videos. The show is called Reality Asserts Itself, and on Reality Asserts Itself with Paul J., author Max Blumenthal discusses his new book and traces the rise of Avigdor Lieberman and current policies of ethnic cleansing in Israel. This is from about a week ago, October 27.
Now joining us in the studio to talk about his book is Max Blumenthal. Max is an award-winning journalist and best-selling author whose articles and video documentaries have appeared in the New York Times and many other publications. His most recent book, as I said, is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. His last book was Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, which was a New York Times and Los Angeles Times bestseller. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be on with you.
So your book, you deal with episodic, different episodes, or you can say glimpses of Israel and this growing overt racist culture. And I say overt because, many people will argue that if you have a state based on a religion, you're already into kind of a core of a racist idea, or at least ethnic idea in the very formulation of the ideology that goes with that state. But how open and how many people seem to accept the openness of this rhetoric certainly shocked me when I was there again just about 3 years ago. So early in the book, you quote a poll, and let me quote it. In 2009, a poll of Russian immigrants, 77% supported forcibly transferring Palestinians out of Israel. So talk about this wave of Russian immigrants and who's primary political representative is Avigdor Lieberman.
Well, as you mentioned, Israel is an ethnocracy. It's not an actual multi-ethnic, multi-religious democracy. It's not a real democracy. At best, you can call it a Herrenvolk democracy because it privileges one group, which happens to be a group of exogenous immigrants who have been settled through colonial methods. Against the will of the indigenous Palestinian population, privileges them over non-Jews who are living in historic Palestine, which is everywhere from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. And so you have this system in place which requires the engineering of a Jewish demographic majority. This is really like, as we're opening the interview, we're getting to the essential idea in my book, which is that when you have a system like this, you naturally, you go through a historical process. It could take 100 years, it could take less time, in which the state moves to a terminal phase of overt racism and even proto-fascism. I never call Israel a fascist state or describe the political atmosphere as fascist in the book, but I quote almost dozens of leading liberal Israelis like Uri Avneri, who include founding generation Israelis like Hannah Marom, who performed at the Habima Theater in the original Hebrew plays right off Tel Aviv's Rothschild Boulevard before the state was even founded, saying that fascism is in the air, that we've become a fascist state, and that we're almost ready to divorce ourselves from it. Now, one of the factors in this progression, completely and directly related to the need to engineer a Jewish demographic majority to basically outbreed the Palestinians in this, conflict where virility equaled victory.
Let me just remind you, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz streaming live at freakradio.org. Tell everybody to click on the red oval. Even if you're listening to a refeed or a rerun or an archived version of Mideast Madness, which is the name of this program, you still want to click on the red oval so you can pick up the link, the working link. 11:31 a.m., this is J. Paul's Reality Asserts Itself on therealnews.com website, his interview with author Max Blumenthal. Let's get back to the interview. Mr. Blumenthal is speaking.
was the importation of millions of post-Soviet Russian Jews after the collapse of the Soviet Union. This was the largest one of the largest demographic increases in recent Israeli history, or probably the largest. I think they increased their Jewish population by somewhere like 30%. Somewhere around 300,000 of these Russians have been declared by Israel's state-appointed rabbis to not be halakhically Jewish, or to not actually be Jewish according to Jewish law. So they were convinced by the Jewish agency to come to Israel and reap all these benefits, and now they've been defined as kind of non-Jewish. They're discriminated against to some degree. They're treated pretty badly by the veteran Israelis. And you have Lieberman, who moves into Israeli politics starting in the late 80s, moves into the Likud party, courtesy of Benjamin Netanyahu, and he starts not just talking about the immediate practical interests of the Russian-Israeli public, but talking about their political interests and speaking to their political sensibility, which was not necessarily democratic, which was very authoritarian. You mentioned this poll, 77% favor the expulsion of Palestinians. Actually, a bare majority of Jewish Israelis overall favor the expulsion of Palestinians in that poll. And so Lieberman rises to the top first through the Likud party. He was appointed faction chairman by Netanyahu, I think, in 1992. And then he, I think, moves into Netanyahu's cabinet in a low level in 1996 when Netanyahu comes into power. Then when he runs for election, starting in, I think, 99, he starts picking up two seats every year through the Yisrael Beiteinu party, which catered to Russian interests and showed the political power of the Russian public. And so they're on the one hand, they're campaigning for civil marriage, because in Israel, you have this theocratic system of marriage where, Israelis have to go to Cyprus to get a civil marriage. And for the Russians, who are not defined as Jewish, this is, problematic. And on the other hand, he's campaigning to reduce the amount of Palestinians in Israel and inspiring this racist trend and shouting at Palestinian members of Knesset that you should take your bundles and leave, and that we'll take care of you one day, he said to a member of the Balad party, and basically threatening to kill them, introducing laws to strip them of their citizenship. And then by 2009, which is where my book really begins, Lieberman comes into power in earnest. They had previously had to create these fake cabinet positions for him, like Minister of Strategic Affairs, as if he had any experience in strategery. And finally, Lieberman becomes the third largest, through Yisrael Beiteinu, becomes the third largest party in Israel in the 2009 elections, which were conducted against the backdrop of Operation Cast Lead, this brutal assault on the Gaza Strip, which helped fuel the right-wing mood of the Israeli public. And Lieberman catered to it perfectly, running commercials showing Arab members of Knesset next to statements in which he accused them of expressing disloyalty. And the slogan, the winning slogan of Lieberman, which is also the winning slogan of Likud, is no loyalty, no citizenship. And so he promised to introduce law after law in the next Knesset, and he did, that would eventually strip Palestinian citizens of Israel of their citizenship. And this has become the trend in Israeli society, even though Lieberman has been sort of weakened politically. It's worth mentioning, since you brought him up, that there are two important points. In 2009, Yisrael Beiteinu won high school mock elections in Israel by a wide margin, which shows you where the youth are at in Israel. I mean, not just among the Russian youth, but overall. And at the same time, he just lost an important election in the municipal elections. His candidate in the Jerusalem mayoral election, Moshe Leon, has lost. He was defeated by Nir Barkat, who many left-wing Zionists in Israel celebrate, even though he's behind the Sheikh Jarrah expulsions and behind a lot of the settlement activity in East Jerusalem. So you have right-wing running against far-right, and Lieberman has been temporarily removed from his position as foreign minister because of his ties to the mafia, which I discuss at length. He's going on trial in 2 weeks. I discuss at length how these mafioso figures, like Mikhail Cherny, who is originally a Russian mafia-linked figure, set up these fake companies for Lieberman in Cyprus and put his daughter on the payroll, who was 22 and paid her $200,000 a year and was basically just giving him bags of cash. Just textbook just textbook corruption. And he's been replaced by someone named Zev Elkin, who I interview in my book, who is also from Moscow, also a Russian, but he's in the Likud party. He's even younger than Lieberman, and he's actually even more extreme, and he doesn't even speak English, and he's the foreign minister of Israel, and he favors annexing most of the West Bank, something even Lieberman doesn't favor. So that's remarkable, I think.
Let's get a sense of what Lieberman stood for and how that was acceptable to have a foreign minister that stood for this. Talk about the Lieberman plan, because if you have the two-state solution the way Lieberman sees it, he has a very interesting map.
Well, I think that Plan Lieberman is what the U.S. and Israel are proposing to the Palestinian Authority as the two-state solution. The only difference is that Lieberman proposes to do it unilaterally. And the main element of this plan, which complements the laws that he's introducing inside Israel, which are designed to basically drive the Palestinian citizens out or marginalize them, is to redraw the borders of Israel. He's not going to actually send soldiers into anyone's home and drag them out and send them on buses to Jordan. But there's the Arab Triangle, which are a series of Arab towns which contain a huge population cluster in the north of Israel near the Green Line. And he's basically proposing to redraw the Green Line around these communities and strip them of their citizenship and place them into the hands of the autocratic Palestinian Authority, which strip them of course, all the benefits they're receiving. So they don't want that, obviously. No one wants to be stripped of their citizenship just because they don't have J-positive blood.
I was in Israel in the late 60s. As I said, I don't think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that you could have had a Lieberman as a foreign minister, and Israeli political culture could have accepted having never mind just a minister, but a foreign minister, the face of Israel to other countries, being so overtly racist. But then you could. How do we get from that to that?
Well, you mentioned the late 60s. This was right after 1967 when the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip began. And you had a different political culture in Israel. The labor Zionism was still dominant, although they had sowed the seeds for the rise of Likud. But you had politicians and generals doing more or less what Lieberman plans to do. And you could argue that Lieberman has not been responsible for the same degree. Actually, he may not have been responsible for any degree of the kind of ethnic cleansing that the labor Zionist movement has done. In fact, that's something that you'll hear from the Russian public. It's like, you call us fascists. Well, what about what you did? You committed the Nakba. You ushered in the occupation. And in 1967, Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, first of all, Israeli society was a small state that was unsure of its own survival, insecure, and the victory was like this rapturous moment, which was endorsed by a who's who of the labor Zionist intelligentsia, along with the revisionist Zionist intelligentsia. And I write about the Greater Israel document in Israel, which was basically an endorsement of the occupation and a declaration that the West Bank, which they called Judea and Samaria, is the cradle of the nation. And this was authored by people across the political spectrum with almost no opposition. And it required a lot in order to conquer the West Bank. Massive amounts of ethnic cleansing were required. 300,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes while Abba Ibn, who is, considered this, elegant, silver-tongued, intellectual figure who is revered by American Jews and by Western diplomats.
And always on American television.
Always on American television.
Abba Ibn is a good example of what I'm talking about. No matter what Israel is doing in practice in the real world, the face it shows to the outside world, but also, it seems to me, the face that they want to present to domestic public opinion in Israel, is this kind of enlightened, articulate, cultured man who would never admit to being some overt racist. But then Lieberman can. And I wonder, does this also have something to do with American politics? That is now acceptable in American politics, that Israel can have this face, and it doesn't shake America's support for Israel an iota.
Well, Americans want to believe that there's a good Israel, and you know this Israel strategic deterrence is contingent on projecting good image to Washington. So we're seeing their PR strategy slowly collapse as figures like Lieberman come to the fore. But we have to remember that, you know, the American media, which, you know, shies away from books like Goliath, has actually made pretty, some members of the mainstream press have made a pretty concerted attempt to help whitewash Lieberman. Robert Siegel from NPR hosted Lieberman in Washington at a banquet and interviewed him and was giving him some pretty softball questions in front of a who's who of the Beltway elite. I find this completely remarkable that someone who is actively campaigning to strip people of their citizenship because of their ethnicity was treated in such a manner. But as I said, his successor, Zev Elkin, couldn't even do that interview because he can't even speak English. So it's, you know, really a race to the bottom. And I you know, going back to 1967, there were three villages I write about in the Latrun Gap, which the Israelis considered like this finger sticking into the state of Israel, and it prevented them from building a highway from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. These were ancient villages. One of them, Imwas, was Emmaus in the Bible, and it's where Jesus met with three of his disciples. The Israelis bulldozed all of these villages. Amos Kinan, who was a commander, wrote about it in a really harrowing letter, which wasn't supposed to be exposed. He talked about the church being, you know, the church crashing to the ground, these homes being bulldozed, the families being told to march to Ramallah. And in their place, the Jewish National Fund has built Canada Park, which is a forest, and a lot of American Jews go to visit Israel and they think, wow, they're making the desert bloom. They're planting these trees, and that's how this is promoted to them. When you walk into this forest, as your correspondent Leah Tarachansky did in her upcoming documentary, Seven Deadly Myths, you literally can trip over the ruins of Palestinian homes.
Now, if you look on our site, you can see Leah's story about this forest.
Yeah, and so I think this is a perfect metaphor for the kind of image that Israel tries to project to the outside world, and especially to Washington. And what I've tried to do with this book is to actually get inside the forest and talk about the ruins, talk about what lies beneath these pine cones and these mountains of lies.
Okay, well, we're talking about Lieberman, who represents, you could say, the far right of mainstream Israeli politics and the ideology policy of expulsion and ethnic cleansing. But what I thought very interesting in your book is that if you look at one of the figures of the center, Tzipi Livni, who represents one of the supposed centrist politicians, had a policy of expulsion not so different than Lieberman's. So in the next part of our interview, we're going to talk about the Israeli center and the policy of ethnic cleansing in Israel. Please join us for part two of our interview with Max Blumenthal on Reality Asserts Itself on The Real News.
Okay, folks, end of interview. Dead air, dead air, dead air. Stand by, please. Hello? Hello? Okay. Someone calling me after two rings and apparently hanging up, no doubt to remind me, to point out to me, stupid old Wren, that we had dead air. I briefly, the last moment I decided it was a pretty important thing for me to run out and move my car. So, we are indeed back on the air. Again, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org. What you heard up until an unknown number of minutes ago was an interview of author Max Blumenthal, American Jew, by Paul J. on the Reality Asserts Itself program of October 27th. Let us see if we have access to continuation of this interview. Yes, I have it right here. What you heard was Max Blumenthal's introduction to portions of his latest book just out, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Now here's part two. Ethnic Cleansing and the Israeli quote-unquote Center. Here we go.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore, and welcome to Reality Asserts Itself. This is a continuation of our series of interviews with Max Blumenthal, author of the book Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Part one of our interview, which I suggest you watch before you watch this one, part two, so you get all the context. We left off with a critique of right-wing Israeli overtly racist politics, and at its core is the policy of expulsion, taking away citizenship from Arab Israelis and pushing them into occupied territories. Well, this segment is about the Israeli center, and how different is it? It's positioned as being more moderate. So here is a quote from Max's book, speaking about Tzipi Livni, who was then foreign minister. During the so-called Annapolis track of peace process negotiations that lasted from 2000 to late 2008, Livni attempted to transform the negotiations into a forum for salvaging the Jewish demographic majority through transfer. Livni demanded that the Palestinian Authority allowed Israel to transfer a series of impoverished Arab towns in northern Israel located near the Green Line and all their non-Jewish residents into its hands. He continues further down. In a 2008 meeting with then-Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, Livni emphasized Israel's rejection of Palestinian refugees' right to return to their confiscated land and property inside Israel on the grounds that the refugees threatened Israel's Jewish character. Rice, an African-American raised in the Jim Crow American South by a pro-civil rights Baptist preacher, shuddered at the implications of Livni's statement. Quote, I must admit that though I understood the argument intellectually, Rice reflected, it struck me as a harsh defense of the ethnic purity of the Israeli state when Tzipi said it. It was one of those conversations that shocked my sensibilities as an American. After all, the very concept of American rejects ethnic or religious definitions of citizenship. Moreover, there were Arab citizens of Israel. Where did they fit in? Now joining us in the studio to discuss his book and the center of Israeli politics is Max Blumenthal. Max is an award-winning journalist, best-selling author, whose articles and video documentaries have appeared in many publications, including the New York Times. His most recent book, as I said, is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Thanks for joining us again.
Good to be with you.
So talk a bit about, first of all, it's kind of alarming or amazing that someone could actually alarm Condoleezza Rice, given what she was up to in the Bush administration. But talk about the so-called Israeli center.
And Rice eventually came around to supporting this position that Livni was offering. But, yeah, you mentioned Tzipi Livni, and she's currently in Netanyahu's cabinet as the leader of the Hatnua party, which is supposedly a centrist party. But she's promoted to the American public as the peacemaker. You'll see her on stage with John Kerry on one side and Saeb Erekat, the Palestinian Authority negotiator, on the other side. And she's portrayed as she's there to cover Netanyahu, basically. But we have to see her as a product of the same political environment and mentality as Netanyahu. She comes from the Likud party. She was an aide to Ariel Sharon, and she really at heart is kind of a Likudnik, but she uses much more enlightened rhetoric, except during Operation Cast Lead, when she said that our troops behaved like hooligans, which I demanded of them, which is sort of a remarkable statement she's never been asked about in interviews here. But in this case, she's advancing a plan during the Annapolis track of negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority back in 2007, where she is advancing Plan Lieberman through negotiated means, where they will redraw the borders around about 25,000 Palestinian citizens of Israel and strip them of their citizenship to enhance the ethnic purity of the state of Israel, as Condoleezza Rice said. And so after that meeting was exposed, this happened behind closed doors, when the Palestine papers were leaked, when the minutes of these conversations were leaked by a disgruntled Palestinian negotiator, Ziad Klot, who I interviewed, leaked them. Avigdor Lieberman and Yisrael Beitenu were just overcome with joy. And in the Knesset, they celebrated. They said, Tzipi Livni has embraced Plan Lieberman. And so they invited her to a Yisrael Beitenu faction meeting. And she was extremely embarrassed by this because it damaged her image. Of course, in Israel, it didn't damage her image because she can barely get elected a dog catcher. But in the West, it threatened to damage her image. Of course, it wasn't reported in our press here. But now you start to see where the supposed center and the far right really line up. And it's not just the center. It's everyone all the way to Meretz, to the extreme end of the Zionist left. They reject the idea of Israel as a state of all its citizens. And they're all engaged in this mock debate, which really is over the size of the cage Palestinians will live in, jumbo size or small, because they all agree that Israel has to engineer a Jewish demographic majority against the will of the indigenous Palestinian population. The question is how to do it. So you have bills that were introduced well before Netanyahu came into power, like the Citizenship and Entry Law, which was passed. It's the only law like it in any Western putative democracy. And this bans Palestinian residents of the West Bank from marrying Palestinian citizens of Israel. Meanwhile, I mean, if I move to a settlement in Hebron and I meet a woman from Tel Aviv that I want to marry, of course I can do that because I'm Jewish. So it's clear apartheid designed to manipulate the demographics. And the Supreme Court, when this bill was and this was supported by centrist parties, it was supported by members of the Labor Party, including Ehud Barak, when it was appealed before the Supreme Court of Israel, the court usually approves these decisions based on security. That's how they kind of dismiss it, even if it's a racist bill. They'll say, well, we need to do this for security. But in this case, their opinion actually acknowledged the demographic needs of the state. And this was the court under the control of Dorit Benish, who is considered a liberal in Israeli society. Another bill that was introduced in the last Knesset by Benjamin Netanyahu was an amendment to Israel's citizenship law, which imposed loyalty oaths for new applicants to become citizens of Israel, which demanded that they swear loyalty to the Jewish and democratic state. This was first introduced by Meir Kahana, the rabidly racist rabbi who was eventually banned from the Knesset for racist incitement. And now it's been embraced not just by Netanyahu, but by Ehud Barak, who was then the leader of the Labor Party, who voted for it and supported it. And so Haaretz actually published an article, I think by Chaim Levinson, declaring that, you know, Barak has come around to Meir Kahana's position. This is really where the center-left and the center of Israeli politics are today.
Talk a little bit more of some of these loyalty laws. And as a part of this process of stripping people of citizenship, which seems to go hand in hand with the idea of redrawing the map of Israel that are going to put many Arab towns, in theory, into the occupied territories.
Well, there is the most remarkable of these laws was the Nakba law, which, you know, the Nakba is a reference to the Palestinian catastrophe, the ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Palestinians from what became the State of Israel in 1948. It's a continuous process, and there are Palestinian citizens of Israel who go out during what is known as Israeli Independence Day, May 15th, 1948, which also happens to be the date of their that marks their catastrophe, and they'll observe the tragedy of this moment for them.
Okay, before you get into the Nakba law, go one step backwards and talk about the Minister of Education that actually wanted to reference that there was such a thing, an expulsion and a Nakba that took place. And let me read a quote from the book. So once again, Nakba means catastrophe in Arabic. And this is, as Max said, the day of the founding of Israel and also the expulsion of thousands of Palestinians. And here's a quote from the book about what happened when someone tried to reference these events in Israeli textbooks. In 2007, the battle over the teaching of the Nakba came to a head when Israel's education minister, a relatively liberal member of the Labor Party named Yuli Tamir, attempted to introduce a mild reform to the Arab curriculum. Quote, "The Arab public deserves to be allowed to express its feelings," she explained. "A grade school textbook authorized by Tamir, Living Together in Israel, Textbook for Homeland, Society, and Citizenship, featured one line acknowledging the Nakba as an important and painful chapter in the history of Palestinian citizens of Israel. It read, some of the Arab residents were forced to leave their homes, and some were expelled, and they became refugees in the neighboring Arab countries. Some of them became refugees and were forced to move to other Arab communities in the State of Israel because their villages were destroyed during and after the war. That single line, written for the consumption of Arab third graders, set off a national firestorm of outrage and indignation at the highest levels of Israeli society." What happened?
What happened was that Limor Livnat, who is a leading member of the Likud party, warned that teaching the Nakba promoted disloyalty to the state and was a recipe for the destruction of the state, really highlighting the insecurity of Israel and the state of Israel and many of its leaders over 60 years after carrying out the Nakba, how insecure they were about merely teaching it, that she demanded that the book be removed from shelves and that its publication be suppressed. And she was joined by many other right-wing figures.
The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, weighs in on this as leader of the opposition.
Yeah, Netanyahu warned that this was a calamity for the Jewish people, that this one line was in this textbook. We have to remember that most Palestinian citizens of Israel go to separate Arab schools where they're instructed in Hebrew and Arabic, and they're banned from teaching the Nakba. The teachers cannot teach the Nakba. The teachers are vetted by the Shin Bet to prevent them from teaching the concepts that
Israeli intelligence.
There's just the Israel General Security Service, kind of their version of the FBI, but possibly even more aggressive. And so these schools are really closely monitored for the kind of material they teach. And so this one line set off a firestorm with Netanyahu condemning it. And 2 years later, Netanyahu came into the prime minister's office. And under his education minister, Gideon Saar, who is a young right-wing ideologue, who's now the interior minister, they began seizing these books from bookstores, essentially banning this book.
They actually go out to bookstores and collect them and take them off the shelves.
They sent actual government staffers out to collect these books and take them away to, I don't know where they put them, whether, I don't know, did they burn them? What happened to these books? But in a symbolic sense, this was a state-organized book burning because of one line which referred to this episode. And by, I think it's important to mention that polls of Israelis show that large numbers of Israelis acknowledge that the Nakba happened, that there was massive ethnic cleansing. Benny Morris, who's not a very left-wing figure, who actually said during the Second Intifada that the Palestinians are like animals and they have to be put in a cage, has demonstrated through his historical accounts that there was a deliberate project. I mean, he thinks that it was sort of piece by piece and it wasn't very organized, but there was a project to expel hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, and that those who attempted to return were not fedayeen or fighters, they were just trying to reunite with their family and their land. So this has been pretty well established in Israeli society, and I think it's really revealing to see that as late as 2009 or today, with these kind of efforts continuing, that they're still attempting to prevent this information and this history from reaching the Israeli public, including the Palestinian citizens of Israel.
Yeah, you'd think particularly the Palestinian citizens of Israel. It isn't much later that the Nakba law is passed. And what is that?
And the Nakba law is passed in the Knesset, which is built on top of the Palestinian neighborhood of Sheikh Badr. So I describe that scene in my book, and I describe how the Knesset has become this epicenter of insecurity about its own history. And I describe the attempts to wipe away that history through these laws. And through the Nakba law, I actually interviewed the author of the Nakba law.
Say what the Nakba law is.
The Nakba law was a law that in its original form would have criminalized observation of the Palestinian catastrophe on the day of Israeli Independence Day. In other words, anyone who came out and demonstrated waving Palestinian flags, etc., could be jailed for up to a year. The bill was watered down and passed, and in its current form, it allows the government to fine or strip NGOs of finances which participate in these mourning ceremonies. So it's clearly an attack on the speech of Palestinian citizens of Israel and on Israeli citizens, Jewish Israeli citizens who choose to join them. I interviewed the author of the law, Alex Miller. He's no longer in the Knesset. He was the youngest member to serve in the Knesset, and he was the head of Yisrael Beiteinu's youth faction. He was 28 years old. He's an immigrant from Moscow. His Hebrew was not as good as the Hebrew of Palestinian members of Knesset, like Hanin Zoabi and Ahmed Tibi, whose families have been in Israel and historic Palestine since before the state was founded. He knows very little about Palestinians or their history. He seemed to know very little about democracy because he justified this bill on the basis of a non-existent American law that forbade flag burning. And I told him this has actually been shot down in the United States. And many Americans have expressed disloyalty, like Frederick Douglass on July 4th, and he was unable to kind of respond to this. So this was a really one of many uncomfortable encounters that you read in my book. But I think that's another thing. It's very revealing that the author of this law was a 28-year-old immigrant from Moscow seeking to strip indigenous people of their rights.
In the next segment of our interview with Max, we're going to talk about the primary face of Israel to the West, Benjamin Netanyahu. But he also has in his past, certainly not now publicly, but in his past, also promoted the idea of expulsion. So please join us on the next segment of our interview with Max Blumenthal on Reality Asserts Itself on the Real News Network.
And this is the Mideast Madness Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming at freeradio.org. I did not think that I would care to play all the videos. The full interview of Max Blumenthal by Mr. Paul J. I'll tell you what, I see that there are five here. Let's hope that there are no more than five, because I intend to play all five. They're, as you know, about 15 minutes each. Alas, there are only 54 minutes left in the show. It is 12:06 p.m. this Saturday, November 2nd. Don't forget, you can call. Do not hesitate to call me at any time. Don't worry about interrupting the video or anything. Call me at area code 831-427-3772. Again, the line direct to the live studio is 831-427-3772 this November 2nd, 2013. At 12:06 p.m., let us go to part three. Netanyahu's Greater Israel, based on expulsion and annexation.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore, and welcome to Reality Asserts Itself. We're continuing our series of interviews with author Max Blumenthal about his new book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. In the previous sections of the interview, we've been talking about the far right and the center and their policy of expulsion of Arab citizens of Israel. Of course, the primary face of Israel is Benjamin Netanyahu, its prime minister, who would not overtly talk this way these days. But at the root of his thinking, he seems to not be in a different position than the others we have covered in this series. Here's a quote from Max's book. Like every Israeli prime minister before him, Netanyahu's strategy depended on increasing the number of Jews living on Israeli-controlled territory and reducing the number of Palestinians. In November 1989, while he served as a junior minister in Shamir's government, Netanyahu spoke at Bar-Ilan University, the academic mecca of religious nationalism in Israel. Quote, Israel should have taken advantage of the suppression of the demonstrations in China, in Tiananmen Square, when the world's attention was focused on what was happening in that country, to carry out mass expulsions among the Arabs of the territories, end quote, Netanyahu told his audience. However, to my regret, they did not support that policy that I proposed, and which I still propose should be implemented. Now joining us in the studio is Max Blumenthal. Max is an award-winning journalist and best-selling author whose articles and video documentaries have appeared in many publications. His most recent book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So Benjamin Netanyahu would, again, not allow the West to see this face of his, but this seems to be at the part of his ideology as well, the idea of expulsion.
It has been, and, you know, I write about Netanyahu's experience as part of the post-67 generation, and there had always been, you know, a strong right-wing element within the Zionist movement, but it had always been kind of the junior partner to the labor Zionist movement. And Zev Jabotinsky's most famous essay, which he wrote in 1923, The Iron Wall, kind of laid out the strategic deterrence strategy of the Israelis, which is pure colonialism, using kind of a strategy of pure force because they could never make peace with the indigenous Arab population, and so they'll have to suppress them through violence. And Jabotinsky said there's no difference between our vegetarians and our meat eaters. And so Jeff Jabotinsky's press secretary in New York was Netanyahu's father, Ben-Zion. And so Netanyahu emerges from this kind of environment. The Iron Wall was adopted by the labor Zionist movement as the official strategic deterrence strategy of Israel, and it's now embodied in a literal Iron Wall, which is the separation wall along the West Bank. And so Netanyahu moves into Israeli politics in the early 70s, and his comrades are people like Tzaki Hanegbi, whose mother was Geula Cohen, the self-described woman of violence, who is in the terrorist Stern Gang with Yitzhak Shamir, which carried out the bombing of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, which carried out the Deir Yassin massacre, these kind of activities. And by the early 70s, these young Turks like Hanegbi and Netanyahu were actually attempting to move to the right of their intellectual and political forebears, like Shamir and Cohen. Hanegbi formed a group called Castel, which was a student group at Hebrew University, and they were known for attacking Arab students on campus, and he appointed as his guard, the guard of this right-wing club, a young Moldovan baggage handler from Ben-Gurion International Airport named Avigdor Lieberman. And Netanyahu met them both and helped them both up the Likud ranks until they were both in ministerial positions in Netanyahu's first government. So the settlers really celebrated Netanyahu coming into power in 96 because he had these right-wing figures populating the corridors of power. Yitzhak Rabin had just been assassinated for negotiating the Oslo Accords by a right-wing fanatic who went to school at Bar-Ilan University, Yigal Amir, and you just mentioned Netanyahu's speech in 1989 at Bar-Ilan calling for mass expulsion of Palestinians. And so all of a sudden, Netanyahu comes under pressure from Washington to negotiate the Hebron Accords, which have proven disastrous, and he's reneged on the entire agreement, and then the Y River Accords with Arafat. And so the settlers completely turn their back on Netanyahu. His base falls out from under him. And then this view develops of Netanyahu, that he talks tough, that he uses language like you heard at Bar-Ilan in 1989, but he's the only one who can actually bring the right around to make peace, and he actually wants to make peace. It's kind of like Nixon going to China. So when Netanyahu was elected in 2009, many people in Washington who would ally themselves with the Labor Party actually welcomed Netanyahu and saw him as this pushover. And Netanyahu went back to Bar-Ilan University in 2009 and described his vision for peace of two states living side by side, and said that he believes in peace talks, the operative word being talks, because it was his mentor, Yitzhak Shamir, who conceived a plan at the dawn of the peace process to carry out talks for 10 years, and he said this openly, and settle 500,000 Jews in the West Bank. Now, there are almost 500,000 Jews in the West Bank, and these talks have been going on for over 20 years, maybe 25 years, and this is Netanyahu's strategy. And it's been so successful that he no longer has to pretend that he believes in two states anymore. He no longer has to pretend in this vision of peace. So, in 2 weeks ago, Netanyahu went back to Bar-Ilan University to give another major national security speech. And there, in the academic mecca of the religious nationalist movement, he returned to his ideological roots, the real Netanyahu of 1989, the Netanyahu that hung out with Hanegbi and Lieberman. And he declared that the Palestinians are the heirs to Nazi Germany, that they are directly responsible for the final solution and directly responsible for the slaughter of 4,000 Jewish children in Europe, which is completely false. It's an allegation first introduced by Alan Dershowitz, which is unproven. And he said that for us to make peace, we have to first remove the poisonous tumor of anti-Semitism from the Palestinians. There, and he used the word kibush or occupation with a sarcastic tone, to suggest that Palestinian resentment of Israeli, of the state of Israel, has nothing to do with occupation or colonialism. It has to do with pure, endemic anti-Semitism and Nazism. And this is dangerous rhetoric, considering the amount of, just read my book and read about the amount of mob violence targeting Palestinians and non-Jewish Africans, and you hear this rhetoric from the leader of Israel. Words have consequences, and so this was really an episode not just of incitement, but of Netanyahu flaunting his power in the face of the U.S., which has enforced the status quo, allowing the right to grow beneath Netanyahu and go even further to the right. So you look at this progression that I've described, from Yitzhak Shamir, from the Stern Gang, to Netanyahu, who's gone to the right of Shamir, to people in the Likud party who grew up in the post-Oslo era, who never took the peace process seriously, like Naftali Bennett, who's the head of the Jewish Home Party, which is the third largest party in Israel right now and is making gains in municipal elections. People like Tzipi Hotaveli, who's 32 years old and is a rising figure. She's a deputy transportation minister, which is a stepping stone to even higher office. And she has held hearings in the Knesset on the dangers of miscegenation or Jewish-Arab dating. She favors annexing the West Bank. Danny Danon, who's one of Netanyahu's principal challengers in the Likud party, is like 42 years old, speaks horrible English, favors annexing the West Bank, writes these op-eds for the New York Times calling for a single apartheid state. I mean, these people want to bring apartheid completely out into the open. Netanyahu at least has had a strategy to counter the pressure from Washington and maintain the status quo beneath peace talks. So where is the center in Israel? Netanyahu occupies the hollow center, and he has no choice but to consistently move to his right to mollify the right-wing base, while the Labor Party, under the control of Shelly Yachimovich, focuses on things like the price of cottage cheese and the national insurance system, and is bunkering in Tel Aviv and Haifa and in the epicenters of the enlightened public, and completely has given up, or has almost completely given up on the concept of two states, and has relieved Netanyahu of any pressure from his left.
If this concept of annexing the West Bank, then how do they deal with the idea of voting and one person, one vote? I mean, the demographics are clearly against the Jewish state. So if they're going to have it, they have to go to open apartheid, which is you're going to have some people can vote and others can't.
Right. I mean, Netanyahu has already appointed a committee to explore the feasibility of annexing 60% of the West Bank, which is Area C. This area was created under Oslo. It's the area where most of the settlers live and the fewest Palestinians live. And so through Oslo, signed by Rabin and Arafat, the stage was set for this annexation project. We have to see the Labor Party's fingerprints on this as well. And what people like Naftali Bennett claim is through an annexation plan, there won't be enough Palestinians in Area C to compromise the demographic majority of Jews over the whole land. They can be given citizenship. Meanwhile, the rest of the Palestinians in the West Bank will live in these kind of Bantustan clusters surrounded by walls and checkpoints with their movement limited, and they'll be given Jordanian citizenship. So Palestinian quasi-state is off the table. Apartheid's in the open, but the Palestinians will be given the same kind of status that Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem have, and then you have a small amount who will be given some kind of putative Israeli citizenship, and then the Gaza Strip will just exist as this kind of territory with this kind of besieged human warehousing project that will have no connection to the West Bank. And eventually the goal of the Israeli right, which they've expressed openly, is to hand Gaza over to Egypt, which I can't really foresee happening. But they have a very clear blueprint, and they intend to make good on it.
And the U.S. is well aware of it. This idea of expulsion.
It's not just about expulsion. It's more about ghettoization and human warehousing and apartheid. I don't know, but you can expect, though, that in Area C, I expect that if this plan comes into place, Palestinians who gain citizenship in Area C will start to face a more aggressive wave of settler attacks to push them into Area A, the Bantustans, where they can then be stripped of their citizenship. And I mean, if you look at how Israel's handled citizenship in Jerusalem, they've actually enacted laws which have been validated by municipal courts, where Palestinians who previously who had moved to areas of Jerusalem that were declared part of the Jerusalem municipality, which used to be in the West Bank, they've told them that if you move there after 2004, when it became part of the Jerusalem municipality, you can't gain residency and you only have PA status. That sounds really complicated, but I'm just trying to illustrate how Israel's been able to carefully manipulate demographics through areas where it's taken control.
And this is the deal they want the Palestinians to call a two-state solution.
Well, no, I mean, we're talking about the annexation plan. The two-state solution is actually...
What is the sector that's out of the 60%? What do they call that? It becomes a what?
I mean, that's what would become the Palestinian state under a two-state solution that they can't seem to negotiate. But the people...
The idea is if you can't negotiate this structure, then you do it unilaterally.
You do it unilaterally, and instead of giving the people in Area A, which is the big cities, Ramallah, Bethlehem, Hebron, Nablus, Palestinian citizenship, which would give them votes at the UN and enable them to increase moderately some pressure on the state of Israel to give them more rights to airspace and that kind of thing. You give them Jordanian citizenship or Jordanian residency, which enables, it improves their freedom of movement, but it strips them of their Palestinian identity. And that's, again, all of this is contingent on Washington, and Washington maintaining the status quo for so many years has brought this plan into the open, and the future leaders of Israel intend to make good on this plan, and I see no evidence from Washington that they will do anything to counter it. In fact, when you really talk to diplomats who are in the tank, who are in the beltway, and you say, well, do you have a plan for what comes after the two-state solution? Because it's not going to happen. The best thing they can tell you is we will increase aid to the Palestinians. That's what John Kerry and Tony Blair's plan is that they introduced at the World Economic Forum in Jordan, was $4 billion economic plan to dump more aid and charity into these occupied Bantustans and the Palestinian Authority as a substitute for a state. I mean, and is that acceptable? Can the world accept that? Well, we know that the United States can accept it.
When Netanyahu gets 20-some-odd standing ovations in Congress...
35, more than Barack 35. Obama got during the State of the Union.
How aware of all of this do you think the members of Congress are?
The members of Congress could give two craps. They could give less than one iota of two craps about what happens over there. This is one of the few pieces of reporting in Peter Beinart's book, The Crisis of Zionism, that I thought was really valuable, which is he had sources who told him that each member of Congress got a VIP ticket for Netanyahu's speech, and they each brought their top donor from AIPAC. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's a member of Congress, who is, you know, kind of a key link to the Israel lobby, was giving hand motions on when to cheer and when not to. And so, you know, but the point of this is that the Democrats and the Republicans are engaged in a bipartisan project to deny the Palestinians any future. And for a liberal Democrat, why reject all of the donations that you're being offered and basically set yourself up for the kind of rancorous political environment and antagonism you're going to receive when your real agenda focuses on serving your constituents and maybe getting them better health care, providing them with services, and bringing pork barrel projects back into your district? So the Palestinians have to be sacrificed for all that. And I don't talk about U.S. Congress in my book. I don't talk about geopolitics very much. I don't talk about the broader Middle East very much. I just talk about the consequences of this policy on the ground, the facts on the ground that have been created by the U.S. policy, by the bipartisan consensus around maintaining the status quo in Israel-Palestine.
Well, that's one of the criticisms of the book that's so far hit the press. And in the next segment of our interview, we're going to talk about some of the criticism of Max's book. Please join us for the next segment of our interview with Max on Reality Asserts Itself on the Real News Network.
This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval. It's 12:24 p.m. this Saturday, November 2nd. I'm Ren Tawil. We are playing a series of five video interviews that of Mr. Paul Jay on his internet news program, Reality Asserts Itself. Mr. Paul Jay is interviewing Mr. Max Blumenthal, American Jew, journalist, author, blogger. Blumenthal came out with just very recently his new book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. There may be, hopefully we'll get through the five videos, or for you, of course, the audios that are available here. If there are more than five, we won't get past the fifth one. We might not even be able to complete the fifth one, but just to remind you, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 12:25. Now, part four, Architect of Apartheid in Israel. Quote, if we don't kill, we will cease to exist. What's that all about? Who's saying this? Part four of the Max Blumenthal interview by Paul Jay.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore, and welcome to Reality Asserts Itself. We're continuing our series of interviews with Max Blumenthal about his new book, and he now joins us in the studio. Max is an award-winning journalist, a best-selling author, and his last book, before this one, was Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. It was a New York Times and Los Angeles Times bestseller, and of course, this book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Thanks for joining us again.
Good to be with you.
So you have a profile of a very fascinating guy in the book, and I want to read a quote. His name is Arnon Sofer, and I'll read a quote from the book, and then we'll talk about him. As with everything that guided Israel's national policy, demographics were an overriding factor. Quote, unilateral separation doesn't guarantee peace, Arnon Sofer, the so-called Arab counter, who helped devise the Gaza separation, remarked in 2004. It guarantees a Zionist Jewish state with an overwhelming majority of Jews, end quote. Echoing the stark forecast Dayan presented at Nahal Oz almost five decades before, Sofer spelled out the implications of the withdrawal. Quote, when 2.5 million people live in a closed-off Gaza, it's going to be a human catastrophe. Those people will become even bigger animals than they are today with the aid of an insane fundamentalist Islam. The pressure at the border will be awful. It's going to be a terrible war. So if we want to remain alive, we have to kill and kill and kill all day, every day. If we don't kill, we will cease to exist. So tell us about Arnon Sofer, because when I read this quote, I first of all wanted to know, well, is this some like crazy guy on the margins of Israeli society? And I went and we'll put up his picture for you. This guy's a real guy. Sofer is one of the University of Haifa founders, amongst other things. Since 1970, he taught, mentored, and is involved at the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces Command and Staff College. In 1978, he became a professor of the National Defense College and was appointed head of the College Research Center in 2007. He's retired now, but he teaches senior people in the military. And this is his quote, kill, kill, kill if we want to exist.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to see everything that's happened since 1893 something that is as a blueprint that's been meticulously planned and designed to confine the Palestinians to as small a space as possible, with the most Palestinians in the smallest space, to reserve the most land for Jewish Israelis. Arnon Sofer has really designed the policy of the last maybe decade or 15 years that has defined the political and geographic and even the military environment in Israel. He's one of the most influential people in Israel in the post-Oslo era. And most people watching this right now have never heard of Arnon Sofer. Arnon Sofer is nicknamed by his colleagues at Haifa University Arnon the Arab Counter. And that's because he is a demographer who's obsessed with conceiving policies and plans to engineer the Jewish demographic majority until well into the future. And you heard this quote about him talking about Gaza becoming sealed off and the Israeli army being required to kill and kill all day, every day, otherwise we cease to exist. This is right before the Gaza withdrawal, as it's known, when thousands of settlers, mostly religious nationalist settlers, were withdrawn against their will from the Gaza Strip, and the Gaza Strip was promptly placed under siege. Hamas was elected, fended off a coup from Fatah, and the siege was tightened. And Arnon Sofer's prediction really came to bear. The Israeli military calls it mowing the lawn, but they mount these periodic strikes with or escalations, which culminated with Operation Cast Lead, with drones where they're constantly attacking and harassing the civilian and population of Gaza, and also attacking whatever military targets they can find. And this relates to the general policy of separation. Israel has officially separated with Gaza. It no longer has settlements there. It has no desire to be among the people, and so they have basically become surplus humanity. Gaza has to be warehoused. Then Sofer devised this policy because the Gaza Strip consists of 80% refugees who actually have connections to land inside Israel, primarily in southern Israel, were ethnically cleansed in 1948 and in the years afterwards, and they'd like to return. So this is a way of maintaining the Jewish demographic majority. But even before that, Sofer produced an influential monograph called Israel 2000 to 2020, where he predicted the end of a Jewish demographic majority between the river and the sea, unless Israel carried out a certain blueprint. And he sold Ariel Sharon on this blueprint right before Sharon became prime minister. And it demanded that Israel build a separation wall within the West Bank, surrounding the major Jewish settlement blocks and bringing them into what would be a future Jewish state, then confining the Palestinians to what he called three sausages, which are the three major Bantustans of the West Bank, which we talked about before, the three major population areas. This was what convinced Sharon to begin building the separation wall, which has caused so much misery among Palestinians. And it's actually a policy that the Israelis, that Sofer refers to as hafrada, or separation, which is really eerily reminiscent of the Afrikaans phrase, apartheid, which means separateness. It's through this policy, Sofer's ideas have influenced and even animated the political reality today in Israel, where Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza have basically disappeared from Israeli life, or they're not as present inside Israel proper. And so Benjamin Netanyahu is able to boast of this kind of one-way peace and preside over it, where Israelis are at the beach in Tel Aviv, they're at cafes in West Jerusalem, and they don't fear Palestinians anymore, and they hardly see them anymore. Early in the 90s, Yitzhak Rabin declared his goal was to take Gaza out of Tel Aviv, and that's happened under Netanyahu. During the Second Intifada, when there was a wave of suicide bombings, Haaretz, the voice of the liberal Israeli public, declared that the repression campaign in the West Bank of the Israeli army was a war for croissants in the morning and beer in the evening, because it was the cafes of the enlightened public that were under attack, the bars of the enlightened public that were under attack by suicide bombers. It was Benny Morris's cafe that was bombed in Jerusalem that led him to this extreme right-wing conclusion that Palestinians have to be placed into a cage. So they have been put in a cage under Sofer's policies in the Gaza Strip and increasingly in the West Bank. And this has allowed Netanyahu to enjoy political stability, to enjoy the complicity of the Zionist left and the enlightened public, and the support of the right as he expands settlements. And Netanyahu refers to this environment as peace without peace, or this policy as peace without peace. In other words, that Israelis are enjoying a one-way peace, while Palestinians are constantly harassed and besieged, and there is no agreement possible. As long as there's peace without peace, Netanyahu remains dominant with no clear rival or challenger.
All right, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And in the next segment of our interview, we're going to talk about some of the criticism of Max's book. Please join us for the next segment of our interview with Max on Reality Asserts Itself on the Real News Network.
It says here on their closing page, no government or corporate ads and no ads. Donate to make real news possible. Again, this comes to us courtesy of the Real News Network, or I'm sorry, it says here, therealnews.com, therealnews.com, real, R-E-A-L. It's 12:35, there's 50 minutes left of the program. We will hopefully play all of part five. Don't forget, you can still call me. Well, let's put off the calls for this show. I want to make sure we get through part five. So the phones are now closed down. Here is video number five. If I can, let's see, number two, three, four. Video part five, racism occupier. and the occupied.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore, and welcome to Reality Asserts Itself. This is a continuation of our series of interviews with Max Blumenthal, author of the book Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And he now joins us in the studio. Thanks for joining us again.
Good to be with you.
Criticism of your book, of course, is emerging as you do interviews and people read the book. You mentioned the terrorist attacks that took place, especially during the Second Intifada. I think something like about 700 Israelis were killed during this early 2000s. One of the criticisms of the book is you don't deal with some of the external reasons for this growth of more overt racism in Israel. One of your critics from The Nation, Eric Alterman, he writes the following. Blumenthal evinces no interest in the larger context of Israel's actions. Potential threats that emanate from Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, Syria, Iran, etc., receive virtually no mention in these pages. Israel's actions are attributed exclusively to the myopia of its citizens. Blumenthal blames, quote, Israeli society's nationalist impulses, end quote. It's politicians who struggle, quote, to outdo one another in a competition for the most convincing exaltation of violence against Arab evildoers, end quote. It's fever swamps, quote. It's unprovoked violence against the Arab outclass. And it's textbooks that indoctrinate Jewish children into the culture of militarism. It would have been easy for him to at least pretend to be even-handed here. Did it not occur to Blumenthal, for instance, that Palestinians have textbooks as well? So what do you make of his criticism? And I need to add, I've read much of Alterman's other criticisms, and it seems to me it's just someone out to get you, and I'm not going to deal with them because I don't think they're all that significant or serious. And we have actually invited Mr. Alterman to come on the show and make the criticisms of his book directly to Max and let them discuss and debate it. And Mr. Alterman said, no, thanks. But is there something to this that the book doesn't deal with? For example, the effect of terrorist attacks on cafes and what that did to help the right consolidate this more overt racist position.
I talk about that explicitly in the chapter called The Big Quiet. Alterman didn't read my book. It's just pretty clear he didn't read my book. However, his desire for me to condemn Hamas and Hezbollah before I can talk about the roots of the crisis is ridiculous and almost an anti-intellectual, and his plea for even-handedness is hypocritical if you read his own writings on the false objectivity of the Washington Press Corps, which insists on playing, on the one hand, there's the Democrats' policy, on the other hand, there's the far right wing of the Republicans' policy, and he always criticizes that, but he wants me to be even-handed between the occupier and the occupied. What I'm trying to do is elucidate an idea which is not very complex, it's actually very elementary, which goes to the heart of the crisis in Israel-Palestine and the roots of the Palestinian armed struggle and Palestinian violence, which is resistance to settler colonialism. And we witnessed it in the United States with the Native Americans using violence and including acts of terror. They killed women and children in their homes in Western frontier settlements at times because they were being dispossessed. We witnessed it in South Africa. The African National Congress, under the control of and direction of Nelson Mandela, carried out an armed struggle, including terror attacks against the white Afrikaner population during apartheid South Africa. And we've witnessed it among the Palestinians, and the root of this crisis is not the occupation of 67 per se, although that's a huge part of it. The roots of it are a settler colonial project that began in 1893, and we've just witnessed the historical progression. And what I talk about is, the current phase that it's in, which I think is a terminal phase. But I also discuss the historical roots. And this is a debate that I had wanted to engage in with liberal Zionists. I think it's an honest debate that can be had. But Alterman, you've found maybe the only paragraph in the thousands and thousands of words that he's written in these series of screeds seeking to impugn me in my book, which he has named the Book of the Month Club for the Hamas Book Club. This is the... I didn't know such a thing existed, but, you know, I want to just... give big ups to all the friends of Hamas out there, you know.
Hamas being
of Oprah. No, it's classic McCarthyism, but you found one paragraph where he offers a sort of hackneyed mainstream Zionist analysis.
Let's forget Alterman.
I want to say something more, which is that he's one of the few liberal Zionists who's actually attempted to offer an extended critique of my book, and this is what he's able to come up with. It's very hard for them to grapple with the facts and the analysis that are contained in my book, Goliath, and that's why they're shying away from me. I think that's why Peter Beinart will never allow himself to be in the same forum as me. He's even backed out of a televised panel when he found out I was on the panel.
Is it getting any mainstream reviews?
Well, there's one review that's notable, and it is by someone who could be considered a figure of the Zionist left in Israel, Akiva Eldar, who is a veteran Israeli journalist who's been reporting on this situation for, I think, as long as 30 years. He's written an incredible book on the settlement enterprise called Lords of the Land with Edith Zertal, who's an Israeli professor and an expert on the Holocaust in Israeli life. And he has written an extremely positive review of my book, even though I think he might disagree with a lot of my conclusions. He has called on people to answer the challenge that's contained in this book. And he said that this book reminded him of the reality that had faded into a bas-relief because he'd been so inured and become so immune to the daily acts of petty violence and racist incitement that are all around him. He almost forgot it existed. I reminded him of its presence. And so compare Akiva Eldar to Eric Alterman, someone who's a denizen of the Upper West Side, versus Akiva Eldar, who spent 30 years pretty much in the trenches of Israeli politics. And compare their reviews, and I think you'll see a pretty strong contrast, both in their level of experience and understanding of the crisis and in their review of my book.
There is, true or false, there is serious trends of Jewish hatred, anti-Semitism, amongst the Arab world and amongst Palestinians. It exists.
Definitely.
There is a trend within Palestinian politics that would like to see Israel gone and would like to see most Jews leave.
Definitely. It depends on what trend you're talking about.
I personally talked to an official from Hamas in Beirut who essentially told me, you know, someday we're going to have so many rockets, meaning Hezbollah in Lebanon and Iran and all of this, that the threat of all this is going to drive Jews in Israel to the airports.
I can tell you stories about that. When I'm meeting people who've been driven from their homes, I met a family who was living 3 kilometers from their home, which was now occupied by artists and had been turned into an art studio. And they welcomed me. And then the daughter, I said, what do you think will happen in the future? And the daughter, who was 12, who spoke very good English, said, well, the Jews will eventually leave. And you can call that anti-Semitic if you want, but this is what often happens in situations where the relationship of a group, of a settler group, and a group of indigenous people is defined in colonial terms. And that's the kind of environment that the state of Israel has created, where they're constantly fearing being thrown into the sea. But it was Palestinians in Jaffa, in the Manshia neighborhood, who were literally thrown into the sea and forced away on boats, and the refusal to allow them to return is what highlights, what animates this sense of insecurity and this fear that those people will eventually return. And the longer that that Goliath continues to bloody his hands, he's constantly worried, like any bully is, of who will rise up and finally stab him in the back and fell him. And so it's this kind of relationship, the colonial relationship between Palestinians and Israeli Jews, that is at the root of the whole crisis, and it's what has to be upended if there is to be a just peace in the Holy Land. So, I mean, when you talk about the fears of the Israeli public, you're talking about fears that don't necessarily have to be there. You're also talking about the fears that are particular to the Israeli public that looks at history from a European perspective and sees their past and even their future in Israel. I mean, the exodus of Israelis is already happening. As many as 600,000 to 1 million Israelis are living abroad. And my book ends with a portrait of Berlin, where 15,000 Israelis are already living in the city where the Final Solution was planned. They've taken, most of them taken citizenship, and they love it there. And this is where they are able to experience freedom and light and justice. They've turned their back on the gloom and doom of Netanyahu, and they don't have to go through this experience of colonizing another people. So they've already kind of left and moved on, and this crisis will continue. So how can it be ended is the question. We have to look past a two-state solution now and start looking at the real roots of the crisis. And that's really what's going to, I think, depress the rising degree of classical anti-Semitism we're seeing being promoted in the Arab world, because the colonization of Palestinians is really the key catalyst. It's why Protocols of the Elders of Zion has been a top-selling book in Egypt. If you talk to younger Egyptians, they don't know that Jews used to live in their own country, that tens of thousands of Jews used to live in their own country. They don't know that Leila Murad, the famous Egyptian tarab singer, was Jewish. They don't know that there is a Jewish heritage in Egypt and in a real Jewish heritage. And, when I went to Lebanon, to Beirut, I went to see the Jewish synagogue that was actually shelled by the Israeli army and destroyed, and it's been rebuilt. And I was removed from the grounds because of the level of security around the synagogue. But there is a Jewish heritage in the Arab world. And that's something I talk about in my book, too, through a portrait of my former roommate, Yossi David, whose family comes from Iran and Tunisia, and has decided, I'm an Arab. I feel closer to Palestinians than I do to Ashkenazi Jewish Israelis. And I want to build this Levantine bridge so that we can have a future together after this colonial relationship is upended. So we have to also look past the Ashkenazi perspective on the conflict and look at who wants to be indigenized in Israel-Palestine, who wants to really genuinely live together. And it could be a total bloodbath, like you suggested, but there are also opportunities and possibilities that are opening up that I want to explore, and possible relationships between groups that we have never considered who could actually live together. That's why it's so important to start looking past the hackneyed, worn-out, and obsolete two-state solution, which focuses on ethnic separation, which was based on the idea of us over here, them over there, a concept we've thrown away in the United States as segregationists, and start looking at who wants to genuinely live together and who demands colonialism and insists on its perpetuation for as long as they can maintain it.
All right, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News. Max's book, again, is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And this concludes our series with Max on Reality Asserts Itself.
That is it. That is all five segments of this extended video presentation of an interview of Max Blumenthal, author of the brand new book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. It was just last week, can't even remember what day it was anymore, that I went over the hills to San Jose. I live in Santa Cruz County. I went in over the Santa Cruz Mountains to the San Jose Peace Center to hear Mr. Blumenthal speak. I bought his book, and he signed it for me. I heard many of the same things in these videotaped interviews that I heard in this speech. Well worth the emphasis. Yes, sirree. Radio Cañon is coming up in 10 minutes. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org. That's freak as in F-R-E-A-K, radio.org. Well, the entire basically two-hour program, or over three-quarters of it anyway, was taken up by Mr. Blumenthal's interview. I'm not at all sorry that I decided to go that route. He is an excellent speaker and a very learned young man. This guy, he looks to be about 30 years old. But he joined the ranks of extricated Israeli historian Alon Popeye, who was ostracized and forced to leave his country of Israel, in the ranks of people like Miko Peled, who, even though formerly a Jewish resident of Israel, now lives in San Diego, California, with his family, because Miko and his father, the latter of whom was once a hero general in the Israeli army in the 1967 war, he became a peacenik, and his son was brought up in the peace tradition as well. Max Blumenthal, I expect we'll be hearing a lot more from him. Thank you for joining me. Time to open the door for Mr. Cañonazos. Radio Cañon at 2 o'clock. I'll be here again next Saturday. If not me live, then me in the form of a recording. Every Saturday, 11 a.m., Mideast Madness, the weekend edition. And, of course, I'll talk to you in 2 days at 3 in the afternoon. Here at Free Radio Santa Cruz for Mideast Madness again this coming week, Monday at 3 and Saturday at 11 a.m. Don't forget, you can leave messages at MideastMadness@gmx.com, MideastMadness@gmx.com. Thank you for joining me.